This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 165, like nothing we've ever seen before. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is John Mills. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Paramount's plans for a resort in London, Kate Mulgrew's upcoming memoirs, and we look back at 20 years of Generations. Then in the feature, we're joined by Drew Stewart and Norm Lau to discuss the TOS episode, The Naked Time. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, John. It's great to have you back here on The Ready Room. It's been quite a while since you co-hosted with me, but I do need to take this moment to officially on the air welcome you to the network as a permanent member of our hosting team now that you've joined Mike and Max on Commentary Trek Stars.
Thank you very much. I'm tickled pink. I am happier than a Tiberian bat in a in a blood farm. It's a great thrill, and I'm glad to be part of the family. And thank you for having me back on The Ready Room.
Oh, absolutely. So a Tiberian bat in a blood farm. I don't know if that's ever been written into a Star Trek script before, but I hope it will be sometime.
You're welcome, future writers of Star Trek.
Well, John, let's jump on into our news here. And talking about writers and Star Trek, we're going to look not forward, but backward to Generations, because it's really, really hard for me to believe and a little bit scary as I feel that I'm getting older, that it's been 20 years since Star Trek Generations was released.
Mind-blowing. Honestly, mind-blowing, because I can remember the girl that I conned into going with a group of us as an opening for me to ask her out on a date. And I didn't marry that girl, but it's the first time I've thought of her in a while. And it's been a long time since I spoke with her. So,
wow.
Yeah. While giants mark time.
Well, November 18th was the date that it was released. And I remember it really well. I did not con a girl into going into the movie with me, but I did go with my friends there from in university. A group of us went to the theater to see it. And what I remember more so, though, isn't seeing it on the opening weekend, but it's seeing it later on towards the end of its run when it was no longer in the theaters in Tuscaloosa. So a group of us wanted to see it one more time. So we drove up to Birmingham, where it was still playing in one of the largest theaters there. And we saw the movie. We met my father. He watched it with us because he was living in Birmingham. But what he handed to us while we were there was a videotape of the premiere episode of Voyager, Caretaker, because in Tuscaloosa, there was no UPN affiliate, so we couldn't see Voyager.
Wow.
So we saw Generations. We got the videotape from my dad. We drove back to our house in Tuscaloosa, and then we all sat around the TV, and we capped off the day by watching Caretaker.
Wow. I guess this is the mark of being a Trek fan, but I hear that, and I'm like, oh, that's not a bad way to spend the day.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. That VHS. There's another mark of time right there.
And what I remember, too, is that those early episodes, it was probably a combination of the effect and my particular model of television, maybe, because back then you did have these funky things that would happen. But when there's that Voyager passes by the star and there's the glare, like the white glare, the vertical hold would go crazy and it would spin. Yes. And then it would go away.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Vertical hold, all of that. Wow. Like now it's like a flashback in my brain of all of the things we had to technologically deal with home viewing. Well, here's a question. You saw Voyager's premiere episode the same day you saw Generations. Which one did you like better?
Well, I had seen Generations already probably 3 or 4 times anyway. By the time, mm-hmm. you know, this was like our last viewing, so we had to drive out of town to see it. I don't know. You know, it's a good question because, you know, it's always exciting when they're going to put together a new crew, because I remembered watching the DS9 pilot a few years earlier, and now here's another one, and what are they going to do with it? And so I guess on that particular day, I would have to say it was Caretaker because that was the new experience. Now, if I'm weighing the two stories together, I don't know, probably Generations, because, you know, seeing Kirk again, seeing the 23rd century bridge with the Enterprise B again, for me, right. was important. And just seeing the TNG crew on screen was great.
I have such conflicted emotions about Generations. I'm going to be completely honest that now, who I am now, it's definitely not my favorite Star Trek film. It is. I have issues with the film as a whole. I think there are some elements to it that are beautifully shot. I think that there are some legitimate, well-scripted moments that play well. And even though, much like every other fan, I think, or not every, you know, that's a broad term, but a lot of the people I know personally felt very let down by Kirk's finish in that film.
Yeah.
And, but I remember when I saw it in the theater, to this day, I still think the precise moment, Kirk's final bit of dialogue, is actually well handled. Like, I think that's a moment that's always going to stand out for me. And I remember being in the theater, seeing it for that first time, and thinking, wow, they went the exact opposite of what I expected Kirk's ending to be.
Yeah.
It was very...
Well, of course, they reshot the ending, but
well,
they ended up going the exact opposite of what you expected.
Yes. And I can tell you it was a better choice. Having him have a quiet death, as it were. And I thought that Shatner played it well. I still think he played it well. But I still have such conflicted feelings about it. It was, at the time, I really enjoyed it. And I remember I had a friend who really didn't. And I remember we just couldn't come to terms with each other on that. And in that time, he softened. And I have Wayne. So, like, we're sort of meeting in a middle ground at this point about the film.
Well, what better way for Kirk to go out is just saying it was fun, right? I mean, that's his character. He's not someone who's going to dwell on death. It's just, you know, it's another adventure, and it ended that way for him. So, I remember seeing grown men crying in the theater when Generations was out, when Kirk's death scene was on the screen.
Sure. Sure. I can believe that. And, you know, there is a bit from Generations that I still apply today, which is the moment when he realizes in the Nexus that things aren't right is when mm-hmm. he does the horse leap and he says, it didn't scare me that time. Mm-hmm. And I do, I do Tough Mudders, it's not a competition, but they're obstacle courses. And I actually, you know, was talking with somebody about it and they said, why do you do it? And I said, because I'm terrified of some of these things. And I just want to prove to myself that fear is not going to stop me. And they said, well, when are you going to stop doing them? And I said, honestly, I'll probably stop doing them as soon as I'm not afraid. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of that moment in Generations where it's not right if it's not causing some sort of reaction in you. There should be something, you know, it's that whole thing about what you're doing should trigger some, you know, if you can find something that triggers that passion in you. So I thought that was a good theme in the film.
Agreed, yeah. Yeah, I was not disappointed when I went to see it in the theater. I thought it was great. I don't know what my expectations were going in, and we had just come off of All Good Things, which was such a great story and such a great episode.
Yes.
I guess a lot of fans were expecting them to top that because they had the big screen budget, but they're different stories. And I don't think that it was necessary to pass the baton. I guess that's the one thing I'll say.
Agree.
Like, I don't think that we needed to have an on-screen moment where Kirk in the original series cast hands the baton to Picard and the Next Generation cast. But I also don't mind that they did it either. And I really enjoyed the movie. That's why I went to see it over and over in the theater. I enjoyed the soundtrack. The soundtrack still reminds me of Christmas, even now, because I listened to it all through the holiday season that year in my car.
Sure. Well, it's McCarthy did the score, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a good score. Even when there's a Star Trek film that you're not nuts about, the score is still good. So
yeah,
that holds true here.
It was great. So a few little interesting tidbits here. This is one that's been making its rounds. I've seen it in a few places this week. But reminding everyone that Generations was the first movie to have a website devoted to its publicity. So that shows you how long the World Wide Web as we know it has been around. It was really a new thing.
Yeah. The first. Wow. The first. That's amazing. Because you just think how much everything has shifted in those 20 years. Like, you can't even have something without a social media campaign now.
Right.
And we couldn't even fathom the way they market the stuff online now. Not back then.
I'm not sure if the site is still actually up anywhere. I do remember seeing it just a few years ago. I don't know if it was like archive.org or some place where you could actually still access the pages. And I didn't see that today, but TrekCore has a PDF of the original website that you can download, and you can actually see what it looked like. And of course, it's very primitive by the standards of today's websites. But it's fun to look back and think that, you know, at the time, that was kind of a big thing. And you could go in and there was the Starship console that you could play around with on your little 640 by 480 low-res computer display.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, just the idea of having to choose between a graphics-heavy site and a text-only is...
Oh, yeah.
What? You know,
like, and of course, graphics heavy at the time. It has pictures, right?
Right. There are a couple
not
of
not two megabytes worth of images to download, but just there's a picture there.
Right. There's an actual JPEG on this site, not just a GIF.
So, but I remember that site at the time. I remember going there, and wow, it's just amazing to think about. I think about the 2009 website. When you went there and all the multimedia they had and the image of the doors being closed with the Delta. Yeah.
Yes.
So we've come so far.
We really have. We really have. That's amazing. You know, somebody should actually take the time. I would think it would be really interesting to take a tour of the Star Trek movie websites since Generations.
Yeah.
And you can probably very easily mark the trend and the edge of technology marching through, because Star Trek has, in a sense, that responsibility to always have that cool website up there. They have to do something, because if you go to, you know, a Trek movie website and it doesn't deliver something that is uniquely, you know, tech, you know, like a certain type of wow factor for whatever time it's released in, people will be a little disappointed. The average fan would, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you expect that from Star Trek, right? So, well, a few other things here. Tidbits about this movie. Now, here's one that we were talking about on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
That I've had many debates with people about this over the years. The fact that there's no colon in the name of this movie. It's Star Trek Generations as just three words with no colon. And people always insist that there's a colon in the name, and IMDb even lists a colon in the name, but there actually never was one.
Yeah, that's that is unique. And you have to think, I guess, Into Darkness did the same thing. So I suppose that's a tradition that they kept going through.
But they insist that that's not a statement. Star Trek Into Darkness is not a sentence. It's not a statement, they say.
Well, okay. I mean, but there is. I mean, Trek is a verb, and like it seems to flow like a sentence. I suppose maybe if they put an exclamation point at the end.
That would... What, like Operation Annihilate Star Trek Into Darkness?
Exactly. I think that would play really well. I think
and it would be more exciting than the subdued nature of 2009 in parentheses. Star Trek, right. 2009.
Right.
So there's that tidbit. And box office numbers are always interesting to me as well. Generations opened with $23.1 million. It had $75.7 million in the U.S. and $42.4 million overseas when everything was said and done. And we did a little bit of digging, and we found the Japan number, which was 1.2 million, I believe, right, John, for the
opening weekend? 1.2. Yeah.
And we couldn't find the final number for Japan, but given that Star Trek is not very popular here, I have a feeling it probably didn't even hit 2. It's probably like 1.5 maybe in the end, because everyone who wants to see it is going to go see it on the first weekend. 2009 made $5 million here. Into Darkness made $10 million.
Now, I have a question. In terms of the number one opening at the box office, that was a pretty strong opening for a Trek movie, wasn't it? Didn't that speak to the crossover appeal that it had, the way that it opened?
Yeah, actually, at the time that this came out, that would have been the biggest domestic opening weekend of any Star Trek film by quite a bit. I mean, before that, it was The Undiscovered Country, $18 million. But after that, First Contact had 30, and then Insurrection, 22, and then Nemesis took us back to where we were before the TNG film started because it had 18. And of course, Nemesis is seen as being this complete, total failure, and yet... Right. It matched the number of The Undiscovered Country, which was the highest opening weekend grossing Star Trek film ever prior to Generations.
Well, I mean, looking at the overall trend, you can see where they saw the fan base shrinking. I think Nemesis spoke, the opening of Nemesis likely spoke to the number crunchers as the Trek franchise reverting back to the fans only.
Now, of course, when all is said and done, Nemesis was a failure compared to the other films because it brought in $43 million domestically, and The Final Frontier brought in $52.
Well, The Final Frontier, that's a greatly underrated film, as anybody who's ever heard me talk, you know, there are some durable themes in that film.
Right. But it is cited as being the biggest box office flop because, of course, the motion picture made 82. It made a lot because everyone was waiting for that to come out. So it didn't matter what the story was.
Right.
It's Star Trek returning to the screen. So, but of course, then we look at the JJ films, $257 million total for 2009, $228 for Into Darkness. So, you know, we live in a whole other world now, though.
Right. And I think that something... Now, box office doesn't necessarily denote a good film because if it did, the Transformers movies are as good as Gone with the Wind. But the simple fact is you cannot deny, even if we as fans might dislike certain elements, you can see that trend from Generations to Nemesis and then transitioning to the JJ films. They've found something that appeals outside of the fan base. And so there's no reason for them to change anything. So yeah, I think, you know, we can go back to Generations and we can look back and we can say this is in a large sense, it's a quaint film compared to where the franchise has gone now on the big screen. And it has its flaws, but I there are enough good elements to it that make it feel comfortable as a Trek fan.
Yeah. That, oh, definitely. Definitely.
You know, I'll never lay into it. I'll never blast it.
Yeah, same here. Well, one last point before we move on to the next topic here is the fact that David Carson directed Generations, and this was actually his feature film debut. He directed Yesterday's Enterprise, great episode of TNG, and so they gave him Emissary, yeah. And he came in and he did the pilot for DS9, and he did some other DS9 episodes as well, but he had never directed a film before, and he directed Generations. And I just find that interesting because everyone's so up in arms about Orci having no experience directing, and then they're giving him the next Star Trek film. But
sure.
They gave Generations to a first-time director as well.
And, you know, I actually remember an article at the time. It's probably in a magazine that's not even published anymore. But I remember reading an article that was published at the time that where they talked to the actors and they were all making remarks about the transition from working on the TV show into the films. And they talked about the fact that as they were so used to the breakneck pace of producing, you know, a weekly television format, that for them, they were thrown off by how slow it felt to move for them, mm-hmm, how much mm-hmm. prep between takes. And apparently Carson was viewed as a good choice because he had worked on the series before and he would know how to speak to the actors to get them to be more comfortable with the mm-hmm. different workflow. So I think that probably went a great deal into their choice.
That makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. All right. Well, it was good looking back at Generations, and it's really hard for me to believe it's been 20 years. It's very, very scary.
Yeah.
But anyway, I still watch the movie from time to time now. So, you know, I think it stood the test of time very well. And we'd love to hear what everyone listening thinks about Generations, what your memories are of it. So come over to our listeners group on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, that's the Babel Conference. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field up there and it'll come right on up. It's a closed group, so click join and I'll let you right in. Or hit us up on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM, or send me email through the website, trek.fm/contact. Would love to hear your thoughts on Generations. So, John, the next story we have up here today is about Paramount planning to open a resort in London. It's like an amusement park. They'll have lots of attractions based on their different film properties, including Star Trek, and they're proposing that it would be open in 2020.
Which is fantastic. I have another reason to try to get to London sometime in my life. Now qualifier here. I want to go to London anyway, but it would be pretty cool to be able to check out a Star Trek land somewhere over there. That would be pretty neat. So long as they don't create a duplicate of the Section 31 building that John Harrison took out.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say like a Section 31 ride where you go in and you get interrogated.
Hey, if they made one where you got recruited, I'd be the first one in line.
Oh, it would be awesome, though, if at the park, if they just had people walking around in all black randomly through the crowd, and those are all the Section 31 agents.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Oh, yes, and not even have them say anything. That's the wink and the nod, because you know you're going to get the sometime fans that come in. That'll be the wink and the nod for the true fans to notice.
Well, this park is going to have more than 50 rides and attractions, and they're going to be based on properties that Paramount owns or its partners own. And it could be film or it could be television. It could be games as well, and even artistic works. I have a feeling it'll be heavily skewed towards film because that's what I feel like the general public, they know which studio owns a film property more so than a television property often.
I agree. Yeah. I completely agree with that. People definitely, because you see the logo, it gets drilled into your brain when you go see the movie.
It's up there more at the beginning a lot, right? Not just in the closing. So I don't know what all is going to be here. And it's, in terms of Star Trek, we don't have any information yet on what aspects of Star Trek they're going to draw upon, and whether it's going to be the Abramsverse. I have a feeling it will probably be, and we've seen this before in the one that they were talking about building in, is it Spain? Is that where we saw? There was one that was going to be, I think, in Jordan, and there's another park in Spain, and they were going to have Star Trek sections, but they're themed off of the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, because that's the Star Trek that Paramount actually owns. So I guess that would probably be the case here as well, unless they work out some deal with CBS. Do you think that makes a difference in the popularity of Star Trek attractions?
It's the, you know, they, when you're building an attraction or a park, you're going for as many dollars as you can draw. And just like we were talking about the box office, obviously they found a crossover appeal with the Abramsverse. To me, it would make the most sense for them to make that part of it mirroring the Abramsverse. Because number one, they don't have to pay anybody else for, you know, any sort of licensing or anything like that. And at the same time, it's going to be the one that's of the moment. And you very much want to strike, you know, of the moment. Like if they brought something that looked like the original Enterprise Bridge from the TV series, the appeal to that is going to be far more limited than, you know, I mean, let's face it, the, with the Abrams Bridge, you wouldn't even need to be a Star Trek fan to walk onto it and look around and go, oh, this looks neat, you know, or because the design sensibilities for the majority of that ship are pretty fun to, I would imagine, to immerse yourself in.
I feel like the NX-01 bridge would be like that as well, though.
That would be, I think that would be fun to go into, but it would, I think also, that one, you know, in my brain, I see that as the more interactive sort of exhibit rather than the Abrams one could be like something you could just walk around. I mean, honestly, the thing is so bright, it could be a gift shop. So
Or it could be an Apple store, which of course many people have said before, but they could actually sell Apple products in there.
And then they're just making money hand over fist like that. I mean, that's, you know, brilliant
marketing.
I'm
just thinking the NX-01 though, if they did that bridge, they could have a person dressed up like Porthos, you know, like at Disneyland, you have the characters, they could have Porthos.
They would, I'd be first in line for that. That would be fantastic.
We have Porthos, you know, cheese fondue restaurant as well that you could go into.
Porthos could be the new Snoopy.
I like that. For me, I don't know. Like, I understand why, and in the artist renditions that we've seen of some other parks here over the past year or so, it's Abramsverse. You mentioned that it's the current one, but when you build a park like this, these things stay around for decades. And I personally think that when we, if we go 20 or 30 years into the future and then we look at Star Trek, I feel like this Abramsverse thing right now is going to be a little blip. And all the Star Trek that we've had before that we all know and all that sensibility and those characters and that design aesthetic is going to remain more familiar to the general public. And in the end, if we walked into an attraction at this Paramount London resort 20 years from now, we would expect the Star Trek attraction to look more like all of Star Trek and not like the Abramsverse.
Fair point. That I do think that's a fair point. I mean, I could present counterpoints to that, but they would be mainly just me being a contrarian for the sake of it and not wanting to cede any ground. But I think that's a fair point.
The reason I wonder about it and the reason I ask the question is just that if part of the goal is to attract Star Trek fans to this resort as tourists, I'm just wondering if basing it on the Abramsverse aesthetic will attract Star Trek fans in the same way that a Prime Universe look would attract them.
Sure. They've got so many pieces going into it, though, that, I mean, for me, again, taking just the sort of the contrarian track, I see the Abramsverse stuff, that design sensibility, in terms of building a park that's going to be around for 20 years. I don't know if this is a knock on it or not, but I see it as more easily repurposed. You turn off a couple of lights, you move a console, and it's like, this is just future land now, you know, that sort of thing, instead of specifically Star Trek. So I think the design sensibility sort of allows them to hedge a bet, maybe.
Okay. Well, I get that. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, if you look at Into Darkness, the bridge of the Vengeance is just the Enterprise bridge painted black.
Yeah. Oh, maybe they could do, maybe that would be one of the experiential rides. You know, you could be facing on the separate bridges, and then halfway through, both teams run to the other side and have to try to outgame each other.
So the bridge would be, one half would be black and one half would be white, and it would be like you were in Let That Be Your Last Battlefield?
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Well, we will see where this goes. I will be interested, to be honest with you. I'll be interested to see if they even build this park in the first place, because oftentimes these types of projects get proposed and then they never actually happen. They never actually get built. But maybe they will. I've been watching over here in Japan over the past year, the Harry Potter area of Universal opened over in Kansai. I guess it's in Osaka. And it's been huge. I mean, just absolutely huge. So who knows? It would be great for people in Europe to have something like this nearby.
Well, I just remembered, too, that Paramount tried to get into the amusement park business before.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And flopped, because all they did was they bought an existing property and it didn't work.
Well, I mean, you know, their central attraction was going to be not like Cinderella's castle. It was going to be Platypus Man's apartment from one of the shows that premiered on UPN alongside Voyager. And people just weren't really interested in it.
Platypus Man. Oh, we hardly knew ye.
All right. Well, if you want to know more about this, or if you want to see an image, go over to StarTrek.com. They have, there's not much information, but they do have an artist rendition there where you can see that. Okay, last quick thing we have here in news today, John, is the fact that Kate Mulgrew is going to be releasing a memoir in 2015.
Yeah. Born with Teeth, I think the
title
is.
Born with Teeth. Interesting name, right? I mean, usually you're not born with teeth. You usually cut them.
Yes,
as you get a little older, but...
Hey, you know, she has had a fairly... I don't want to say difficult, but she's a tough person. She's gone through some trials, and I think that the title's very much speaks to sort of the trials and tribulations that she's come through to become a successful actress, but also just establishing herself as a person.
Yeah,
and so, you know, I kind of like the title.
It's an interesting one for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, the story of how she became an actress and all is very interesting. And she certainly persevered. She saw something she wanted and she made sure that she got it and she was successful. And she certainly is not one of those actors and actresses who kind of walk into it because they're from a family that has the connections, you know, where their parents were actors. You know, she really worked to get where she is.
Right. And it's been a heck of a trajectory, you know, starting in soap operas, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and granted, Voyager, it's still semi-polarizing for the fan base, but she's one of the captains, you know, and, you know, she's definitely an interesting person. I'm kind of interested. I don't think this would go to the top of the list, but having seen her interviewed by Shatner in his documentary, she's a person I think has an interesting story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Absolutely. So she's going to be telling it in 320 pages, and this is scheduled to drop right now on April 14th of next year. We'll see if that happens. Those schedules do sometimes shift around depending on different production factors. But you can pre-order the book right now on Amazon for $20.52 as of today. And there's going to be an audiobook version as well, $22.48. But of course, if you're an Audible member, you'll be able to pick that up for one credit. And I guess it's a great time, John, right, to plug our sponsor, audible.com.
I think so.
All I will tell you is that as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice if you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. Now, of course, this book won't be available for you to pick up right now, but there are some other things on there that I know you'll love. But the audiobook version, when it does come out, it doesn't say right now on the site, but I'm certain that Kate Mulgrew will be reading this herself. And so it'll be a lot like Shatner's books, which reading the books are great. It's great to read them, but hearing it in their voice is so much better. So I do certainly hope that she'll be reading Born with Teeth when it comes out.
Me too. Yes, I think definitely is the logical choice to have her read her story. Absolutely. Yeah.
Especially because I think that in this case, she will be just like Shatner, where it's not so much her reading her book to you as it is her telling you the story.
Yes.
So it really brings it to life. So yes. If you are a fan of Kate Mulgrew, stay tuned for more information on this. We'll put a link in the show notes to Amazon.com where you can actually read a little synopsis of the book, and you can pre-order if you'd like to as well. And it'll be interesting when it comes out, because I love hearing the backstories that people have about their lives.
Same here.
The Next Generation had few connections to the original series, and a lot of that was by design. But one thing that both series share early on is an episode about getting drunk off of water. It's what became known as the Psi 2000 virus in Star Trek later on, but it's called polywater intoxication in the original series. And today we're going to talk about this and all the crazy things that it makes the crew do. And to help us do that, we're joined by a new member of the Trek FM family, but you know his voice from the 602 Club and Warp 5, Norm Lau. Hey, Norm.
Hello, everybody. How are you?
Doing well. Welcome to the Ready Room. This is your first time here on the Ready Room, I know.
It is. And it's a thrill to be here amongst all you fine folk and talk about polywater intoxication, because that's a mouthful.
It really is. It sounds like a marketing campaign for Gatorade gone wrong, right?
Yeah.
So also joining us, as he does for every original series show, is the man who's controlling us all, even if we don't know it, Landru. Hey, Drew, how's it going?
My will be done.
So today we're going to talk about the episode that Drew picked just so he could hear me say the title of it, which is why I didn't say it in my intro. The Naked Time.
Yay!
Delicious.
I know. I just love how grammatically and lack of accent you have, except for that one word.
Yeah. There's that one word. You know, I mean, I am originally from Alabama. I've been gone for a very long time. I've lived in different countries. Speak multiple languages, and therefore my accent has become very strange over the years. But apparently naked is one of those words that's just stuck with me.
It's your podcasting
Achilles
heel.
Try not to laugh every time.
Guess so. It's become a thing around the network, apparently. All right. Well, first of all, as we do every show, we want to give a quick synopsis of this episode. And Landru, as you are the co-host of our original series show, Standard Orbit, why don't you tell us what happens in The Naked Time?
All right. So in The Naked Time, I don't know which episode you watched. I watched The Naked Time. But there's a planet, and it's going to shrink and explode somehow, which is apparently a real thing. They're sent there to study it, but the people who are on the surface that they're supposed to pick up, they apparently went crazy and kill themselves somehow. So an idiot that's down there with Spock scratches his nose and gets infected. And he brings it back up to the ship, and everybody gets infected, and everybody starts acting like they are drunk. Riley,
Oh, you mean Captain Riley.
Helmsman or Navigator. Yeah. Captain Riley.
His rank.
But before he was captain, he was the Navigator. No, he's the Helmsman. I always get it backwards. Yeah. He's on the bridge, and he takes over engineering, and they need engineering so that they can escape the gravity of this planet that's exploding. And then they escape.
The end. Okay.
The end.
So there you go. That's what happens in here. This episode, of course, what you left out of your synopsis, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is probably most famous for a shirtless Sulu fencing.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
It's like nothing we've ever seen before.
Yeah. Right. I had never seen that before. And I've never seen it since.
No, that shot, it is burned in my brain, that shot of him. With the rapier with his shirt off, like that was one of those stock images. Whenever somebody would run an article growing up about the original series, they would have the picture of, like, you didn't even have to see this episode to know that shot occurred, because it was in like one of every three articles about the original series.
Right. Exactly.
Which is part of the problem, but we'll get to that.
I think we need a mashup of that image and then Kirk in his Speedos when he's teaching Charlie Evans how to wrestle in Charlie X.
All first season stuff.
Yeah. Because apparently, those were standard issue in Starfleet at the time. So
I've actually seen that cosplayed, those Kung Fu tights. The Starfleet Kung Fu tights.
Wow.
I was like, wow, that's trying pretty hard.
That's dedication is what that
on
is.
You.
That's right. Confidence.
Well, as we've already said, it was like nothing we've ever seen before. The very dramatic statement by Spock early in the episode. And when I hear it, I always think this is the fourth episode of the series to air. So pretty much anything that you show us at this point is going to be unlike anything we've seen before. But let's talk about our initial thoughts on the episode and the things we do see here. John, what are your thoughts on the naked time?
Honestly, the naked time is it's one of those iconic moments. It doesn't even matter what anybody thinks about the episode, because everybody knows this episode. Everybody knows bits and pieces of this episode, but that's what transfers its iconic status. This isn't a beloved episode, in my opinion. This isn't a hated episode. This is simply one of those episodes where no matter what, everybody knows it. Period and end of sentence.
Definitely. How about you, Norm? I know, Norm, you told me this is like one of your all-time favorite episodes, right?
And it's because it's full of humor and it's full of heart. It's one of those episodes where you can sit someone down and say, you know, you want to watch some Star Trek, and if they're not halfway paying attention, it's okay, because it's not dropping any like huge world building, you know, architecture of storytelling here. It's fun. It's actually a really nice bridge for fans to watch that are new to Star Trek who want to watch both the original series and Next Generation, because it dovetails into The Naked Now, which is perfect. But again, it introduces a lot of humor, whereas the previous episodes before, you know, like The Man Trap and Charlie X and Where No Man Has Gone Before, those were heavy episodes, you know, and that was heavy science fiction. And I think, you know, they tried to lighten it up a little bit. I mean, it was fun with all of the actors, you know, acting, you know, very inebriated and open and honest in certain ways. But they did kind of like harken back to some heavier stuff towards the end. But all in all, it is one of my favorites, because looking forward, Kirk really shows off his passion for his ship. And that really shows off how committed he is, not just to his crew, but how much he loves the Enterprise, as he refers to her as she. So, you know, it's just, again, it's one of those moments that you can just have a lot of fun with and still kind of like have some good moments with the crew.
I think he also showed his passion for his yeoman too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry to look at her, Spock. You can notice her. So yeah, it's a little
you're allowed to.
No walks yeah,
you're allowed
on
to.
The beach.
So, yeah, it's a little on a strange side where they were going with that storytelling, but they took care of that.
Well, what about you, Landry? Where does this fall for you amongst season one episodes for sure, but just TOS in general?
It's a good episode. I like it, but I have issues with it being so early in the series, I feel like this and Naked Now come too early in the series to be really appreciated. We look back on it and we think it's great that, you know, oh, Sulu, because we know Sulu and it's crazy that he does that. And we know these characters and it's crazy to see them do that. You know, Spock, you know, showing emotion, it's such a huge deal. But the issue is we've only seen him in 3 episodes before this point. Him showing emotion, you'll be like, oh, maybe he'll just break down every other episode and show emotions.
Right, yeah, on a first viewing.
Yeah. I mean, going back to it, you could put this later in the series, except for Rand being there. You know, you could put it later in the series and it'd be even better than it is where it is now.
You could make that work. She could be like the Worf of TOS, where she shows up later on in the series and Kirk says, Yeoman Rand, what the hell are you doing here?
Right.
And then she says,
and then she'd start to explain it and no one will listen.
Yeah, yeah. So you could make it work.
I was delivering a sandwich and I got lost in the turbo lift. No, I'm back.
I was heating this coffee with a phaser.
I wandered onto the wrong ship.
For 3 years?
Back at space dock, and here I am. So, yeah. Well, let's talk about this topic right now then. As 5-year mission sings, as they did, of course, at the beginning of the feature here, because that's going to be the lead in music, Vulcans Don't Cry. And when we look back at this right now, it is, like you said, very interesting to see how this affected Spock. But early on, I mean, the 4th episode to air, you have no idea. And just like you said, Landru, that maybe he's going to be like this all the time. Every time they encounter a virus or he gets stressed or, you know, Kirk tells him to pipe it down when you're calling out commands on the bridge, he's going to break down and cry. We don't know yet. So we know how you feel a little bit about it, Drew, but John, what about you? Do you agree that it's very strange to have this type of story at the very beginning of a series?
I would say that I don't necessarily agree with you, Drew, because I think that it's interesting that by being given this, because there's a lot of exposition in that moment when Spock breaks down. There's a lot of talk with Chapel, where she says, I know Vulcans can't do this, and I know Vulcans can't... Like, they're actually sort of outlining everything about Vulcans in this episode and setting up... I mean, in a sense, it's almost a nice tease to show Spock have this moment of emotion and then to see the control afterward. I'm sort of just being a contrarian about it in that sense because I can completely see where you're coming from, but I enjoy they're sort of spelling it out, how difficult a journey Spock is going to have in the overall sense of things. And so I think it works. And in terms of the other characters behaving out of character, as it were, I think that Bones doesn't. Bones is very much in character mm-hmm. through the entire episode. Kirk is in...
Well, I have a theory on that.
No, Kirk is in character through most of the episode. And just seeing the scene where Kirk just slaps the living hell out of Spock is, it's still humorous to this day.
I think I know where Landry is going with this because I have a theory as well about Bones and Scotty, since they were both able to function very well to the peak of their performance.
I didn't even think of Scotty.
These are the two biggest drinkers of the bridge. So they're
not affected because they are constantly drunk.
So their tolerance for alcohol and, you know, side effects, pretty darn high. So they're not worried about it, which I thought was kind of fun, especially with Bones, because without Bones and him not being able to translate the serum to the rest of the crew, I mean, they were pretty much dead in the water. Same thing with Scotty not being able to cut through into the Jeffries tube. But think about it, you know, traditionally, you know, these guys, they're the ones that can throw down some serious drinking with you. So
maybe there's something in mint that neutralizes the intoxicating effect of polywater. So it's all those mint juleps that Bones drinks that was sort of the key to saving the crew.
And for Scotty, it's whatever it is that he drinks that's green.
Right.
That makes him not affected.
But I agree about the point with Spock is there was a nice time where he walks into the officer's ready room and he slams his fist and he's really fighting with the human side of himself that's being brought out. And I think that's the first time we actually see the writers explore that side. It wasn't the best way of doing it, but, and maybe taking it to tears may have been a bit too far, but it was a nice part of exposing the human side of the half Vulcan, half human dichotomy, that which is always, you know, a conflict for Spock. And that really brought it out in the foreground. Again, it may have gone a little too far, but I think that was probably to cue in Kirk so that Kirk would slap some sense into him, you know, in order to knock him out of that funk.
Well, but to key onto that too, you know, television of that time period, the acting was much more melodramatic. And so to take it to the point of tears, I think would have, within the mean of television back at that time, would have been within reason. And so, like, we look at it with modern eyes and might think that that's too far, but
that's a good point.
You know, they're looking for big explosive emotions back then.
I can see both sides of it. I think that, you know, the point, especially what you said, John, makes sense here, but I also see your side, Landrew, that we, it's almost impossible to really feel how it was for the viewer, because even if we're watching it for the first time today, like you just said, John, television is different. You know, what we're accustomed to for acting is very different now as well. But, you know, you never know with, let's say, Riley. We really don't know anything about Riley. So the fact that he's acting unusual by taking over engineering and singing and pretending to be the captain, we don't know if that's unusual for him or not. You know, maybe he just loves musicals. Maybe he's like Matthew, my co-host on Literary Treks in the Orb, who looks for every opportunity to break out into song during a show. You never know what he's really like. And then Sulu as well. We don't really know yet if Sulu's normally calm and composed, or if he really is just always looking for a chance to go down to the gym and work out, get off duty, ditch his job. We kind of don't know yet.
No, so. I feel like that he does.
You think he does, yeah.
Sulu, I think he does. Oh, when's work over so I can go work out?
That's right. Yeah. And then I'll go tend to my flowers and plants afterwards. So yes. He's got very diverse interests. Except, of course, being on the bridge.
Yeah, right. He uses the sword to trim the flowers. And he gets everything all together.
What about Chapel? You know, we're finding out very early on that she has some feelings towards Spock, and putting that within context of how it plays out over the course of the rest of the series, what did you make of that?
Now, this I can see being good for the rest of the series and starting with this information. So I'm kind of going back and forth, John. You managed to open up my cold heart about
victory,
about the characterizations. But yeah, it does help, say, in Chapel's case, because it would be kind of hard to portray on a weekly series that really has no continuity. You know, like, oh, she kind of looks at him longingly out of focus, barely in frame of these shots. But her coming out and flat out telling Spock so early in the series, you know, we get stuff like an amok time, you know why she's bringing him soup and stuff like that. And it also, it's a good scene because it shows that Gene Roddenberry wasn't just hiring his girlfriend for fun.
Yeah.
You know, she's got some acting chops in her.
It's interesting to watch Nurse Chapel this early, again, with no real barometer of her character to expose herself like that. And I agree with Landrew. It's neat to have kind of like Spock and Chapel on one side and Kirk and Rand on the other side, with these strange relationships kind of like coming to the surface, because at one, it's Kirk that's actually yearning for Rand, where as a lonely leadership position, and on the other side you have Chapel, you know, who's not in a leadership position, looking at a leader for relationships. So there are these really interesting writing bits that are going on. But it's, again, it's a little too early to tell if exposing that type of a relationship or seeking a relationship for Chapel to Spock was you know, is what they wanted to do all along, or if it was just kind of serviceable for the script and then they developed it later on. So it's, I really don't, you know, I don't really, I like what she did with it, but I just didn't, I don't really think that it was planned for the overall arc of the character, but.
Mm-hmm.
If I recall correctly, I believe that the original writer had a random character expressing their love for Spock, and that they actually suggested it be Chapel.
Okay.
Hmm. Whether that was because, you know, it's Gene's girlfriend and we, you know, you should probably use her because we're paying her to be on set anyway. Hmm. And how much of it was them planning for the future, I don't recall that.
It's interesting that you say that it's Kirk yearning for Rand here, because something we talk about often is the popular view, conception that Kirk is always after all the women on the ship and all the alien women as well. But in a way, this shows how much control Kirk maintains all the time, right? Because it's only when he's affected by this virus and he is unable to control his emotions to the level that he normally would, that he even reveals this to Spock in the first place. Otherwise, he maintains very professional relationship around Rand.
Yeah.
Until she disappears.
Well, also, that's one of, I think this is one of the better earlier moments for Kirk, when he's really struggling with this part of his command, and he admits to being, you know, it's lonely, you know, that it would be nice to share someone in my life. I mean, it could have been Rand, it could have been somebody else, but then he reins that in and focuses back on the ship. And I think that this is one of those moments in Star Trek where we start seeing him really forge the relationship of how much he loves being the captain of the Enterprise. You know, it's like, now I know why they call her she, you know, and that, along with other instances later on in all the different, you know, episodes and the movies, is where the anchor point is to when his heart breaks, when he had to make the sacrifice for the Enterprise in the search for Spock. That is one of the, I think, single greatest relationship arcs in science fiction and in Star Trek per se, because it's how much he loves protecting this ship under his command. It's his duty, and he takes that very seriously and very solemnly, and that's probably the only thing that really overrides his own personal desires, is how much he loves being in command of his ship. And I don't see that really with a lot of the other captains. They take their careers very seriously, but Kirk was the one who really loved the ship, in my opinion.
And sometimes the ship loved him.
If he had holodecks at that time, it could have been legendary.
Well, yeah, I wasn't really going there. I was just thinking about when the computer kind of fell in love with him.
I mean, me neither. What was I thinking? It was, I must be polywater intoxicated right now.
Put your shirt on, Norm.
Where's my foil? Hey, how about a workout, guys?
Okay, well, talking about the polywater intoxication, which of course we all know leads to space madness.
As it
everyone,
should.
Be careful if you come in contact with this polywater. It's, you know, I think I mentioned in my opening anyway, that it, or early on, that it's sort of like a bad Gatorade campaign where things just have gone bad, you know, but I've never seen football players take their shirts off, start fencing at midfield. I'm pretty sure that would be a penalty in football.
Indecent exposure.
But yet we do get fencing on the Enterprise in this episode. Let's talk about some of the just the crazy things that the crew does here. What's your favorite side effect of polywater intoxication?
Wow, that's a really tough one. My absolute favorite, though, just because I think it's so silly and zany, is Captain Riley, like, sitting with his feet up, singing to the crew. And, like, I also love, even though it's a tense moment between Kirk and Uhura, you know, he's like, turn it off! And she's like, don't you think I would if I could? Like, I love that moment in the episode. Yeah,
he tries to butt in when I sing, you know, in the lounge. I told him, go away. You don't have the voice for this.
Yeah, so that's my hand. That's got to be my favorite.
Did you notice that when he's giving his new rules about, you know, female crew members will wear their hair loose?
Yeah.
To their shoulders.
The shoulders.
His cadence, it's almost like Captain Kirk giving that as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The way he delivers the lines.
I didn't put that on, no.
Wasn't Riley supposed to have, like Chekhov, been the character or the role that always idolized Kirk? You know, or always looked up to him as we would kind of like use them as the vessel for being that particular crewman? Because that's, you're right, he did a really good job at kind of parodying Kirk at that time. Mm-hmm. Not parodying Shatner, parodying Kirk, the actual, you know, the role of the captain.
Right, yeah, yeah. Like he's, because he says this is Captain Riley, so he's just filling those shoes.
I think for me, probably it had to have been Kirk slapping Spock. I mean, that is one of the, well, slapping an officer is obviously an offense in Starfleet, not at this time, but just him going, cutting loose all over Spock's face. You know, and Spock trying to make this calculation go, it's like, come on. It's like, if you hit me harder, maybe I can make a calculation faster. I'm not sure, but maybe this is what's going on. I can't tell because I'm completely intoxicated by polywater.
It's like right now. It's like one of those flashlights like we keep in the earthquake kit where you spin the handle to build up the, the power the flashlight will come on. If you just keep slapping Spock, that powers his calculation engine in his brain.
I wonder if Spock ever just slaps himself around, you know, to get a, you know, you got to think.
Like when he's at the academy taking his tests.
Right,
he's like,
yeah.
I can't get this answered. Bam, 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 bam. Yeah. All the other students are looking at him like, the Vulcan's flipping out over here, teacher.
He knows what
Vulcans
he's doing.
Vulcans don't cry. They just beat themselves
silly.
That
could be something they do all the time. This is the fourth episode. We can go anywhere from here.
Seeing a Vulcan smack himself is like nothing we've ever seen before.
That's right.
I hope that you insert some kind of that sting that plays after he says that every time that Norm says that.
I think we need that. But what's your favorite, Drew?
I think my favorite is it's not Sulu fencing everybody. It's everyone's reaction to Sulu trying to fence them. Because Sulu's just running down the hall and he runs into these two guys and these two guys are like just staring at him like, what are you doing? And he's like, you know, being all Three Musketeers and the guys are like, what? And then he just pokes at him and they're like, okay. And they kind of wander off. But my absolute favorite is when he gets on the bridge and Uhura just starts, you know, sniping at him. And so he grabs her and is like, aha, I will protect you, fair maiden. And she's like, sorry, neither. And I'm like, that's filthy. That's for 60s TV. Yeah. That's, you know, that's risque.
There's a lot of that in TOS where it's almost as if they were just having fun seeing what they could slip by the censors.
Yeah.
And shooting it in a way where there's no way it could be changed at the last minute.
Clever, clever.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, since you talked about Sulu fencing, which is probably my favorite, just kind of way out there side effect of this, I'll choose another thing that I always find funny in this episode, which is when the crew members decide to take the torch and cut Texas into the wall of the corridor.
No,
because it's what it looks like.
Those people weren't infected, Chris.
Or that's just what they do.
That was their job, to cut Texas into the wall.
And I think that the people who spray painted the walls, I think they also probably were not intoxicated. They just saw an opportunity. They've been wanting to vandalize the corridor for quite a while.
Because if anything, the set needs more red.
Right.
I'm disappointed that Gertrude was not in this episode because I wanted to see what Gertrude, Sulu's flower, would do if it were watered with some polywater.
No, you got Audrey too happening then.
Oh, yeah. Oh. It grows, it starts talking. Yeah. Feed me, Sulu.
That's what happened to Rand.
Maybe it picks up a tiny fencing foil as well. Oh, Well, okay, so the virus itself is a pretty big threat, and in most Star Trek episodes, it seems like that would be enough. Like, we're all intoxicated, we've got to find a cure before time runs out. But that's not enough for the original series. We also have to deal with shrinkage. And this is a real thing, especially when you're dealing with a very cold planet, like they are in this episode. And the planet's just shrinking below them. And it's also like it's reaching out and yanking them, they say. And they've got to figure out how to avoid being doomed along with the planet here. So, Landry, what did you think about this added threat? As if the virus weren't enough, the planet below us is crumbling and it's going to do us in as well.
I like in this and Enemy Within the addition of having the time limit, because, you know, if it was just, oh, we've got to get Kirk back together, or, oh, we're all drunk, you know, we should do something about that. But having this, you know, we should do something about that in the next 5 minutes, and oh, they turn the engines off, which takes a half hour to fix. I like the added tension. I the effect of it, like I watched the original effects tonight, the effect of it, of the planet, isn't very well done. Like, it's just spinning faster. I mean, I don't know if a planet shrinking makes it spin faster, but the effect could be done better. But I like the clock, and not the actual clock that Sulu looks at later, the clock, the ticking clock on the mission.
Was there a
clock? I mean, I don't remember Naked Now very much because I've only seen it that one time. But is there a second plot, like, oh, we got to fix this before we all die, or are they just running around drunk?
I don't remember time lock in the Next Gen version. I really don't. I remember not particularly caring for it, and so as a result, I've never gone back and been like, oh, that's one I'm gonna. I'm like, yeah.
Oh right. No, it was an asteroid.
Asteroid?
Yeah, it was coming towards them. I think there was a gravitational pull. And they had to be able to get the ship moving, or else, because they were in the way of between the asteroid and the gravitational pull of the planet.
Because instead of Captain Riley, you had acting Captain Crusher, Wesley Crusher, who taken
locked
over
himself
engineering,
in engineering.
Right?
If there's one scene that they would have really, really done true homage by in the Naked Now, if Wesley was getting slapped around by Data to try and find a formula for a cold restart of the warp engines, or using the isolinear chips and just peppering him with it at full speed. But if Data hit him like that, it would have killed him, so we can't have that. So.
Right.
But it would have been neat to see. And it would have ended Wesley Crusher in the first season, so. My
it
apologies
is funny,
to Will
you know,
Wheaton.
I don't know why. I've just never thought about it, I guess because, you know, these are not two of my favorite episodes. Until you bring that up, Landru, I never really thought about the fact that they did take Riley and replace him with Wesley on the Next Generation variation.
I mean,
he
literally locks himself in engineering.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Which really seems like it should be harder to do, regardless of which series you're talking about. Like, there should be...
Right.
You know, so many fail-safes to keep somebody from locking themselves in.
At least Wesley, like, locks himself in a corner of engineering, right? It's not like like Riley, where he was just like, hey, everybody, you should not be in here anymore so that I can lock this one door.
Right. It seems to be a flawed design in that circumstance. Definitely.
I mean, you can believe Data locking out a ship with all the overrides and all the voice mimicry and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, you're right. Riley's like, everyone leave.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to sit here, lock the doors, right. Order ice cream, and sing one more time. You know?
So. It's like nothing you've ever heard before. Okay.
Now, I have a crossover here. This needs to be a YouTube video. So Riley, he's locked himself in engineering. He's sitting in that chair. And he's singing. If you could bring Wesley in, and then Wesley could use his handheld tractor beam, which he uses to move a chair in the Naked Now, he could actually move Riley out of engineering using the tractor beam.
Brilliant.
This has to be done.
Absolutely brilliant.
I said we Kickstarter this.
Yeah.
Sure. What would we call the Kickstarter?
Nothing that you've ever Kickstartered before.
Perfect.
Sold.
That's perfect. That's perfect. All right. So, well, yeah, I mean, you need the extra threat there. But as if the planet crumbling and shrinking was not enough and the virus was not enough, we've got one more thing to throw into this episode, and that's time travel. So
there's always room for time
travel.
There's
always room for time travel.
Yeah.
Time travel has become such a staple of Star Trek, and I know many of my favorite episodes revolve around time travel. I think it's very easy for fans, this is how I feel anyway, to forget that this episode is the first time we have time travel in Star Trek, because it's not the central plot of the episode. It's just this solution there at the end.
Yeah, it definitely feels like they're setting up. Like, when they originally wrote the episode, this was going to be a two-parter with Tomorrow is Yesterday. But the way that the episode is now, it's kind of just like setting up infinite possibilities that they never really do. Because
possibilities
Spock's like,
that you've never heard of before.
Because Spock says, he's like, we can time travel now. We can go anywhere, any when, and, you know, for no reason at all. And Kirk's like, cool, I guess. So it kind of makes it sound like maybe we're going to be like Doctor Who. You know, we're going to be going, you know, traveling through time and, you know, solving problems and stuff. But in reality, the next time that they travel back in time, it's an accident eerily like this one. And then the only time that they deliberately go back in time is for Assignment Earth, when they're just like, we're back in 1968 for no reason. We're just looking.
Because we can't.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, all of our history books have been lost, and we're going to go back and find out how we survived at this time period.
Yeah. But it's interesting, the choice as to why, because, you know, again, if we saw it dovetailed with Tomorrow's Yesterday, we probably would have figured that out. But 3 days, I mean, it took 3 days for them to spiral down into, and basically into the crux of what was happening with Psi 2000. And then the explosion, the shockwave, you know, throttled them back. But it's kind of like, why? There's no real kind of payoff for that part, right, part of the script. And yes, it's cool because I'm sure in 1966, we're like, wow, they traveled through time and they got all that time back to kind of right the wrongs that happened throughout this whole episode. You know, Sulu can get his shirt back.
They can't change history, though.
No.
Sulu can get his shirt back. It's like, we've got to get Sulu's shirt back on. How can we do it? Why don't we go back in time 3 days and he'll still be wearing it, and then we'll make sure he doesn't take it off.
Right. That's totally
worth it. I'm worried about Kirk's shirt that apparently is made of like some kind of paper.
Isn't that hilarious?
Because McCoy just looks at him and it falls off.
I love that he comes on the bridge. Okay, so I have to think the hypo spray works perfectly fine through the uniform fabric.
We know for a fact that it does.
It does, right? So he comes out of the turbo lift and Bones just grabs his shoulder and rips his sleeve off and then gives him the hypo spray.
Well, again, it's like you have the added threat of the polywater intoxication, the spiraling out of control, the shrinkage, Spock losing his mind, and now Kirk has to deal with one more thing, and that's Bones just tearing his garment in half. Well, why would you do that?
I mean,
could you not have done that?
You know the history of garment malfunctions on television. So here's one right there.
In 1966, it was shocking. Shocking.
Good thing
to see.
It was his sleeve.
Yeah. It was bare shoulder.
And not the front of his shirt.
It was like no shoulder we've ever seen before.
I mean, think about what the FCC regulations would have been like if Shatner had shown a nipple back in 1968.
They would have had to advertise.
Sulu's not wearing a shirt.
1966.
Gotta keep that in mind.
Oh, no. Yes, Sulu has his shirt off, but I mean, this is James Kirk. You know, like if he had flashed, that they would have said,
give him an episode. He'll take his shirt off. It's fine.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Whether he wants to or not.
I think that the reason that happened is Shatner was just like, well, Takei got to take his shirt off. why don't I have an excuse? Well, so, you know, well, Mr. Shatner, you know, you're really, your character's really not, has any reason. What if I get super drunk and take my shirt off because it's just so hot? No, no.
How do you like
me
now?
What if McCoy just rips my shirt for no reason? Yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah, McCoy needs to give me a shot really quickly, and it takes time for it to pass through the fabric of my tunic. So, he could just rip it.
Bill, we're not made of money. We can't just tear all of these uniforms up. These are going to be collector's items someday.
Well, it's not coming out of my paycheck. So. That's part of my contract.
I can't remember which book it was, but I was talking to Dayton Ward about one of the books that he wrote, and he wrote a novel, and the editor came back and was like, you got to rip Kirk's shirt. You know, it's got to be authentic. You got to rip Kirk's shirt. So that's just a thing.
You can literally hear, though, when he walks off the turbo lift, you hear the dun, 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 tear. Problem solved. Just hold it together for five more minutes.
I can see him like, what if I'm walking by and it gets snagged on one of the compounds?
It actually would have been more dramatic if Yeoman ran toward it.
Oh.
And then it was like, no shirt to walk on. So. Dovetails into that nice scene.
This is why you need a journey to Babel-style Andorian fight scene in every episode.
Spock.
Spock here.
I'm on deck 5, near my quarters. I've been attacked by an Andorian.
Yes.
Then you've got a built-in reason to rip the shirt.
Absolutely.
The Andorian stabs a red shirt and then rips Kirk's shirt. And then we've got all the cliches right there.
I'll take your shirt to Andoria.
That's the title of the episode.
Oh, yeah. Well, so one thing I was thinking about watching this again, when we're talking about when they go back 3 days in time, like what do they do with that time? And then I started thinking like, well, is this the earliest example of the reset button? But it's not exactly a reset button because it's not like they went back 3 days and everything that happened to them is gone. They've still got beads of sweat pouring down their faces and they've still been through the effects of the virus. They're just 3 days back in time now.
And they don't talk about, well, now we can go to the planet, not get infected, and then do the research that we weren't able to do because probably the scientists got all drunk and stopped paying attention to the sensors.
Let's make sure that doesn't scratch his nose this time.
Oh, right. Please. I'm sorry, I just got to say.
Is there another Enterprise there? Can they meet themselves and then cause it not to happen? Oh, ow, ow, ow.
What are you saying here, John?
Well, no, I just, watching the CDC in action in this episode was just, it was for me, it's not baffling to watch a 1960s sci-fi television show not know about proper, like, disease protocols and everything like that. But you watch it and you say to yourself, is it possible that somebody could be this uneducated? Like, how could you possibly be going on an away mission? And first off, your hood doesn't even attach to your outfit. And you're supposed to be in this.
Did I put this on right?
Right, exactly.
No.
And then you're like, oh, my nose is itchy. I'm going to take my glove off. Why? What? No, what are you even doing on this mission right now?
Now, John, if I'm not mistaken, now the news that I've heard with the recent Ebola outbreak, that in Texas at that hospital, that some of the nurses that were attending to that first man who had Ebola were not wearing like full gloves and full protective gear. So even in 2014, it's sort of like, what are you thinking about here?
Yeah, it is, but I give modern day stuff, like now we've had this scare and it's like, okay, now everybody, you really have to take these procedures seriously, and hopefully that, you know, that has that ripple effect. But it's just as incongruous to me. And again, I'm looking at it with modern eyes, but you see also that sort of 1960s style, like we're just putting a show together mentality with, when he flips out later, and he's like, "We don't belong in the stars.
Yeah,
we don't belong out here." I would think that by the by whatever star date they're at, that most everybody on the planet Earth has come to peace with the idea of space exploration. Like right. that, even yeah. if you go off the rails, you're not going to hit a point where you're going to say, "If man was supposed to fly, he'd have wings." Maybe you should have.
Yeah, well, that's where the 1960s
there.
View of space exploration yeah. is bleeding through to our characters mm-hmm. who are actually oh, yeah. living in the 23rd century.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
But this episode was almost as if it was an entire kind of almost an extension of Enemy Within, where everyone's split mm-hmm. into these two particular strengths and weaknesses of their character. Mm-hmm. I mean, they always said that Joe Tourmaline was like Bones, like this guy shouldn't have died. You know, he's a fighter. He's the kind of guy that he would beat something like this. And he didn't, because that part of his personality, the weaker side of his personality, was taking over. Riley, on the other hand, his part of the personality, this stronger, I want to be in command. I deserve to be further along with my, you know, my track in my career, than I should be right now. That's kind of like bubbling to the surface. Spock's humanity is bubbling to the surface. All of their weaknesses or strengths are bubbling to the surface. And that's very much what happened in The Enemy Within with Kirk. Both of his egos, his strongest points were focused on. So it's interesting that this episode, in my opinion, strongly characterizes that one particular plot point from With Enemy Within, because when you're intoxicated, and I'm not gonna say everyone, but most people have had a bender that have had a really good night on the town, they become somebody that they've never been at one point in time. You know, you're either incredibly confident or you're incredibly laid back if you're an aggressive guy, or if you're an underconfident guy. So it brings things out of you that you've never seen before sometimes. And you know, this is polywater intoxication. This is, I'm not even going to say it. I think you know where I'm going with that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the polywater intoxication is different. Like the thing that I sort of struggle with the whole intoxication thing, and putting polywater in front of it helps resolve it for me. But yes, you can go on a bender and you can become somebody you typically aren't. But for instance, Riley shutting down the engines, or you have to be on a bender of such incredible blackout proportions to do something that's 180 degrees from your character, from your baseline, that it's, you know, I don't know. I think that putting the word polywater in front helps make it more palatable in my brain, because if they just said, "Oh, they're just acting like they're drunk," it's like hypnosis. You're not going to do something that you, like, somebody can't hypnotize you and put a gun in your hand and say, go shoot somebody on the street. Unless there's something inside you that's like, I have always wanted to shoot somebody on the street. So
isn't that what they were getting at, though? There was something inside of him that, I'm not saying that he wanted to, he was mischievous.
Well, yeah. But mischievous, like shutting down the engines in a critical situation like that. I don't know. Maybe I've never been on enough of a bender to have experienced something like this. Like I would think there would be some tiny part of his lizard brain that would be like, No, bad. You want to be captain. Captains don't do this. Like, it would be so ingrained.
Well, you have to remember that the people that were originally infected, you know, they turned off life support and stuff. I mean, it seems, and Joe tried to kill himself. It seems that the polywater intoxication leads to just self-destructive behavior.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And I wonder if that is, I mean, you know, I read the memos or whatever in Cushman's book. They weren't trying to do this, but you could almost interpret this into a alcohol and drugs are bad kind of story, even.
Oh, like a reefer madness?
You know, like it was self-destructive to be drinking and stuff. And I don't know.
And were you saying, John, a moment ago, I guess, that Yar had always wanted to sleep with Data?
Well,
can you blame her?
I mean, come on. Look, you know, that's one attractive
He's
robot
fully
there.
Functional.
Come on.
Yeah. Well, you said that, you know, you can't even hypnotize someone to do something unless they've got that inside them. Like, I've always wanted to do that. So
that's what I've always been told. I've always been told that you can't force somebody under hypnosis to do something they wouldn't normally do.
You know, one time Alf tried to hypnotize Lucky so that Lucky would be a sandwich so that he could eat him. And luckily Willy walked
did
in.
Did it work?
I mean, that may have worked. I mean, Alf definitely wanted to eat the cat. I don't know if Lucky wanted to be eaten by Alf, though.
Well, the force only works on the weak-minded. And so, you know, cats are just naturally immune.
I can see that.
Well, I think we've run through pretty much all the key points of this episode here. So why don't we close out with our final thoughts and our rating for the episode. Norm, what are your final thoughts and your rating?
Well, I think that I would still recommend watching this as an episode for the original series to anyone who wants to just to jump in and try it, because I think it's fun and it does have a couple of really zany moments, has a couple of pretty heavy moments. And again, it's not something that has to slip in canonically with the TOS overarching story, but it's a bottled episode. So it's one of those things you can come in, you can sit down, you can put it on, you can watch it, you can experience some of the fun with the characters. You can see characters step out of their known personalities, or what you think of their known personalities are, because you're coming at it from 2014 to 1966, and you can just have fun with it. It's not heavy, and it's not meant to be heavy, and I think it was just the writers trying to throw something at the wall and see what stuck. So for me, I will give this 6 out of 10 shots of polywater intoxication.
Wow.
Wow.
All right. How about you, John?
Fun episode, iconic episode. I think that everybody sort of agrees, like, this is a good episode to put on either as a really easy lead in for somebody that's not naturally inclined to sort of jump into Star Trek, especially original series. But it's worth, you know, I wouldn't skip it. This isn't one of those ones where I would be like, no, don't watch that one. Don't watch that one. So, you know, it's fairly substantially middle of the road, enjoyable, with some bright parts to it. So, you know, I'm going to have to give it 8.5 rapiers out of 30.
How about you, Drew?
I'm going to agree that it's a good episode and I'm going to rate it highly, but I'm not going to put it on, and I haven't put it on a list of shows that you should use to introduce Trek. Not because it's bad, but because, again, I still feel that the episode, in showing everybody acting at a character, it's not the best introduction. But it can be like an early episode. I'm now becoming okay with that. So it's a good episode, and everyone should watch it. If you haven't watched it, why are you listening to this? You should have stopped and listened and not let us spoil it for you. Because if you haven't listened to this or if you haven't watched this episode, why are you listening to this? You should, you know, don't let us spoil it for you. You know, we already did if you're listening at this point. So
I don't know. You can't really spoil Spock's emotional moment, in my opinion. So,
right. You know, I'm talking about the little zingers.
Yeah.
Like the Uhura zingers, because those are just the best.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm going to rate this episode 7 out of 10 Uhura zingers.
That's a lot of Uhura zingers. That's beyond my my recommended daily allowance. Goodness gracious.
Yeah, I agree with you, Drew, that I would not put this in a list of, you know, episodes that I would show someone to introduce them to Star Trek, because, well, the characters are out of character, but it's a fun one to watch, and I would definitely watch it from time to time just because it has what, for me anyway, are some iconic moments in Star Trek. So I'm going to give this one a rousing rendition of I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen.
One more time.
All right. Well, Drew and Norm, thanks for dropping by today and talking about this with us. Before we go, Norm, tell everyone where they can find you online.
Well, you can find me online, Twitter and Facebook. That's Norman Lau, NORMANLAO. I'm also on the Axanar fan page on Facebook, and I'm a proud supporter of the Trek FM broadcast shows Warp 5, The Orb, The 602 Club, and Star Trek Axanar, the official Axanar podcast.
Excellent. And Landry, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at 005, DUBLEOFIVE. And you can also find me on Standard Orbit that I co-host with Mike here on the network, where we talk about TOS, and it's a lot of fun. So check us out over there.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks again for dropping by, guys.
Okay. Thanks, Christopher.
Well, it's been fun getting polywater intoxicated with Norm and Drew, Chris.
Yeah, I'm glad that we got the large size jug of the polywater.
Yeah, well, I mean, value is where you have to go. It really is.
Who knew they sold that down at Costco, right? Yeah, it was fun talking about this episode. And now we're going to have to do the Naked Now for our TNG week sometime soon to follow it up.
I see no other choice.
There is no choice. Yeah, it was a great discussion today, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
But instead of it being a human being prejudiced against Vulcans because the Romulans look like Vulcans, the Vulcans are taking advantage of themselves looking like Romulans in order to be racist against Romulans.
Earl Grey.
So he's got the two armrests, and the right one says little, you know, Ensign, you know, Lamont, and a little arrow. And then the one on the left says Lieutenant Commander Data. Like a little arrow.
The orb.
But when they pull away from that window with Jake and Kira, and they pull away from the station, it's like they're closing the book. They're actually closing the back cover of the book, and it's the end of the story.
To the journey!
How do you feel, Char, about the Borg Queen?
Oh boy. I think the longer that I have watched Star Trek, the more I'm in the camp of, I don't know if I like her.
The Ready Room.
They want you to come across on Archer's side where he can be mad at Trip. But I have a really hard time being Archer being mad at Trip, because just think of if we still treated, you know, people of a different race like this.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
That could honestly be the reason they brought Wesley, because Wesley's got nothing else going for him there. I mean, yes, he can lead those kids, but that's just going to be by virtue of his age. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, he's 15 years old. Of course, all the other kids are going to look up to him, at least for a while. Then if he ends up being a total tool, then they won't.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Yeah, well, Learning Curve was never meant to be a season one finale. They were going to do the 37s, and then UPN wanted to open season two with it, and that totally didn't work either.
Man, you gotta say UPN really ooped it up.
Literary Treks.
What Jerry Taylor talks about with Catherine Janeway's life is, it's kind of a series of her relationships. I mean, she should be doing all sorts of fantastic things, right? And instead, we're learning about her boyfriends.
Melodic Treks.
But there's a whole host of people that appear in Star Trek. As I said, most of it is classical, so it's Verdi, Vivaldi, Strauss, Troitschke, Harry Kim.
The 602 Club.
This really does have an impact on, I think, the entire, you know, comic book world. Dark Knight, Dark Knight Returns still have a huge impact in the way that people view Batman today.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. We're in iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, BlackBerry, Windows Phone. You can go to our website. You can stream from the show page. You can also download the MP3 file. If you look on the site, you'll see the thumbnail art for the show, and then below that, the SoundCloud player. In the upper right-hand corner of the SoundCloud player, you'll see the little button to download the MP3 file. If you'd like to do that. And you can also grab the RSS link, and you can pop that into any third-party application that you like. One thing you can do for us to help us out here, if you're in iTunes, is to click the subscribe button. Even though you can stream the shows through iTunes or the podcast app, if you subscribe, you'll get the show as soon as I publish it. And also, those subscriptions help us rise up in the search results, and that helps other Star Trek fans find the show. And also, star ratings help us out as well, as do written reviews. So if you have a free moment, please do those things for us, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. And that also, as I said, does help other fans find the show so they can hear our discussions about Star Trek. Another way you can help us out is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekafilm, that's patreon.com/trekafilm, you'll see our current goals, you'll see our milestone contribution levels, and the perks that we have in exchange for your support. And we have a lot of great perks, like sitting in on show recordings, becoming part of our content development team, becoming an associate producer even of the show. And your support there really does help us keep the shows coming to you. It's actually critical to our ability to keep the shows coming to you every week. So I hope you'll check it out and become part of the team, become part of the crew at patreon.com/trekafilm. And I also want to thank our associate producer here on The Ready Room, Renee Roberts, longtime friend of the network and a big supporter of everything that we do here, not just The Ready Room, but the entire network. And you can follow Renee on Twitter, where she's known as Mariss_1701. And we really thank Renee for all of her help here on The Ready Room and on Trek FM. Now, we would love to hear your thoughts on today's show. As I mentioned when John and I were talking about Generations up front, we'd love to hear your memories of Generations. But of course, anything else that you want to share with us about today's show or Star Trek in general, we would love to hear from you. There are many ways to get in touch with us. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Just choose to send to a show and choose The Ready Room. That'll come to me by email. In social media, you'll find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. On Facebook, we have our regular page, facebook.com/trekafilm, as well as our discussion group for listeners. That's the Babel Conference. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Twitter, and it'll come right up. Because, can you believe this, John? There are not a lot of things on Twitter that use the word Babel in their names.
Really? There aren't? That's actually kind of shocking.
You'd think that'd be everywhere, right? But yeah. No, the Babel Conference is kind of a unique name. That's one reason I chose it. So it's easy to find. So just type that in there or go to our website and click discussion on the menu bar. That'll take you there as well. It's a closed group, so you do need to click join and I'll let you right on in. And we have hundreds of members there right now. We have great discussions every single day. That is a great way to become more a bigger part of the crew and the audience and extend our discussions beyond the shows here. So we hope we'll see you there. Now, John, we already mentioned that you're now a permanent host on Commentary Trek Stars. So tell everyone what else you do and where they can find you online and on the network.
Well, you can find me usually lurking around Twitter, causing all sorts of trouble, at Kessel Junkie, KesselJunkie. And there's a little show called Words with Nerds that I co-host with my pal Craig. And you can find us on the usual spots like iTunes and Podbean. And, you know, give us a listen.
Now, does the license plate on your car, does it say Kessel Junkie, like without the vowels or anything like that?
No, because I'm actually far too much of a cheapskate to pay for the vanity plates. You know, unfortunately not. But I can promise you that if there's a place to have the username, I've staked it out. Like, I'm like Neil Armstrong. I find out about a new service and I'm planting the flag immediately.
I'm kind of like that as well. Well, if you would like to find me, you can find me as well. I'm also on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. And I'm on Facebook and I hang out in the Babel Conference all the time. So again, come join that group. And I'd love to talk to you there about Star Trek. And then elsewhere on the network, you can find me on lots of different shows. The Orb, Warp 5, Literary Treks, Continuing Mission Matter Stream. And also I do the Axanar official podcast with Axanar creator and executive producer Alec Peters. So tune into that if you want to find out more of my thoughts on the world of Star Trek and on shows like Axanar. Listen to great interviews with the actors and the creators behind that series.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing what they're doing.
It is.
With that film. I can't wait to see the full film when it comes out.
I know, right?
Also, before we let you go, I'd like to remind you about Audible.com, our sponsor for today's show, which I mentioned when we talked about Kate Mulgrew's upcoming memoirs. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice if you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm. Just sign up there. If you decide not to stick with Audible, you'll get to keep that book, so there's nothing to lose. But when you try Audible, that also helps us keep the show coming to you every single week. So go support them, and we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network as well. And go check out Enterprise in Space. This is the project of the National Space Society that Larry Nemechek and I are both involved in right now. This is a project to build an 8-foot orbiter called the NSS Enterprise, which we will launch It will orbit the Earth carrying science experiments designed by students, at least 100, probably many more, depending on the design of the ship. And it will be returned to Earth and put into a museum. And you can become a virtual crew member by supporting the project. And you'll be helping science education as well. And also testing out some new technologies, you know, for space travel, which will help us all down the road as we make our way out into space. Another thing that's going on right now, though, that you can enter for free is the design contest. We're looking for designs for what the NSS Enterprise should look like. And if you have an idea, you can submit it. You don't have to be an engineer. We have people who have worked on the shuttle program, people who work for NASA involved in this project. They're going to actually build the ship. But we want to know what you think it should look like. So head on over to enterpriseinspace.org. Find out more about the project. Find out about the design competition. The deadline is coming up in December, December 8th. So there's still time for you to get that in. And who knows, your design could be the one that actually flies into space. Again, enterpriseinspace.org is the URL for that. And I hope you'll go check it out and support the project. All right, John, well, I've got to let you go. I'm going to run back down the corridor, and I'm going to burn the rest of the states in the wall because Texas looks a little bit lonely there to me right now.
Well then, Chris, I'd say it's time to stick Uhura's giant hoop earrings in it because the ready room is done. The ship's in trouble.